This is Audible.
Harper Perennial and Harper Audio present Animal Dreams by Barbara Kingsolver. This is the author. Dedication in memory of Ben Linder. Author's note. Grace, Arizona, and its railroad depot are imaginary, as is Santa Rosalia Pueblo, although it resembles the Carazan Pueblos of northern New Mexico. Other places and crises in the book are actual. I'm grateful for the example provided by many non-fictional volunteers from the United States who went to live and work for a new social order in Nicaragua during the decade following the 1979 revolution. Alongside the Nicaraguan people, they have made indelible contributions to that country and to history. For their support and contributions to this book, I also owe a warm debt of thanks to my editor at Harper & Row, Janet Goldstein, my literary agent, Francis Golden, and my remarkable family, especially Jessica Sampson, locomotive engineer extraordinaire, Wendell and Ginny Kingsolver, Joe Hoffman, and Camille Hoffman Kingsolver, who has attached me securely to this world. Homero, Chapter 1, The Night of All Souls. His two girls are curled together like animals whose habit is to sleep underground, in the smallest space possible. Cosima knows she's the older, even when she's unconscious. One of her arms lies over Helimita's shoulder as if she intends to protect them both from their bad dreams. Dr. Homer Nolin holds his breath, trying to see movement there in the darkness, the way he's watched pregnant women close their eyes and listen inside themselves trying to feel life. A slice of white moon from the window divides their bodies deeply into light and shadow, but not one from the other. No light could show where one body ends and the other begins when they're sleeping like this. Maybe a mother's eye could tell, but that is the one possibility that can't be tried. Helimita's bed is still made. In the morning, she'll rumple it so he'll believe she slept by herself, and then the girls will make it again. Their labors at deceiving him are as careful as surgery. But morning is worlds away now. It's still early night on the Day of All Souls. The two of them spent the whole day playing in the cemetery with neighbor children, Pocha and Juan Teobaldo, and Cristobal and the twin babies, helping Viola Domingos build a bower of marigolds over the grave of a great-grandmother who is no part of this family. For a long time, he stands gripping the doorframe, which is exactly the width of a newborn's skull and curves similarly against his palm. He watches his daughters, though there's nothing to watch, and thinks these words, a great-grandmother who isn't their business. He decides this will be their last year for the cemetery and the Day of All Souls. There are too many skeletons down there. People count too long on the oblivion of children. They're deep in the corpse-like collapse that takes hold of children when they are exhausted. But still, he won't risk going in to stand over the bed the way he once would have. He would see the usual things, unraveled braids and the scraped shins hidden from his punishing antiseptics. Tonight, he would also see cheeks and eyelids stained bright yellow from marigold pollen. He spent a lifetime noticing small details from a distance. From the doorway, he smells the bitterness of crushed marigold petals on their skin. There is a deeper draft of breath, and they both move a little. Their long hair falls together across the sheet, the colors blending, the curled strands curving gently around the straight. He feels a constriction around his heart that isn't disease but pure, simple pain, and he knows he would weep if he could. Not for the river he can't cross to reach his children, not for distance, but the opposite. For how close together these two are, and how much they have to lose, how much they've already lost in their lives to come. Cosima. Chapter 2. Hallie's Bones. I am the sister who didn't go to war. I can only tell you my side of the story. Hallie is the one who went south with her pickup truck and her crop disease books and her heart dead set on a new world. Who knows why people do what they do? I stood on a battleground once, too, but it was 40 years after the fighting was all over. Northern France, in 1982, in a field where the farmers' plow blades kept turning up the skeletons of cows. They were the first casualties of the German occupation. In the sudden quiet after the evacuation, the cows had died by the thousands in those pastures, slowly, lowing with pain from unmilked udders. But now the farmers who grew sugar beets in those fields were blessed, they said, by the bones. The soil was rich in calcium. 3 years later, when my sister talked about leaving Tucson to work in the cotton fields around Chinandega, where farmers were getting ambushed while they walked home with their minds on dinner, all I could think of was France. Those long, flat fields of bone-fed green. Somehow, we protect ourselves. It's the nearest I could come to imagining Nicaragua. Even though I know the bones in that ground aren't animal bones. She left in August, after the last rain of the season. Summer storms in the desert are violent things, and clean. They leave you feeling like you have cried. Hallie had never left me before. It was always the other way around, since I'm 3 years older and have had to do things first. She would just be catching up when I'd go again, swimming farther out into life because I still hadn't found a rock to stand on. Never because I wanted to leave. Hallie and I were so attached, like keenly mismatched Siamese twins conjoined at the back of the mind. We parted again and again, and still each time it felt like a medical risk, as if we were being liberated at some terrible cost, the price of a shared organ. We never stopped feeling that knife. But she went, and true to the laws of family physics, the equal and opposite reaction, I was soon packed up too and headed northeast on a Greyhound bus. In our divergent ways, I believe we were both headed home. I was bound for Grace, Arizona, where Hallie and I were born and raised, and where our father still lived and was said to be losing his mind. It was a Sunday. I had a window seat, and in a Greyhound, you're up high. You pass through the land like some Rajah on an elephant looking down on your kingdom, which in this case was a scorched, bristling landscape and the tops of a lot of cars. It wasn't all that different from my usual view of life because I'm tall, like my father and Hallie. I don't look like who I am. They do, but I don't. It was mid-morning when I stepped down off the bus in Grace, and I didn't recognize it. Even in 14 years, it couldn't have changed much, though, so I knew it was just me. Grace is made of things that erode too slowly to be noticed. Red granite canyon walls, orchards of sturdy old fruit trees past their prime, a shamelessly unpolluted sky. The houses were built in no big hurry back when labor was taken for granted, and now we're in no big hurry to decay. Arthritic mesquite trees grew out of impossible crevices in the cliffs, looking as if they could adapt to life on Mars if need be. I was the only passenger getting off. The short, imperious bus driver opened the baggage door and made a show of dragging out luggage to get to mine as if I were being difficult. A more accommodating woman, he implied, would be content with whatever bags happened to be right in front. Finally, he slapped my two huge suitcases flat out in the dust. He slammed the doors and reclaimed his throne, causing the bus to bark like a dog, leaving a cloud of exhaust in the air, getting the last word, I suppose. The view from here was orchards, pecan, plum, apple. The highway ran along the river, dividing the orchards like a long crooked part in a leafy scalp. The trees filled the whole valley floor to the sides of the canyon. Confetti-colored houses perched on the slopes at its edges with their backs to the canyon wall. And up at the head of the canyon was the old Black Mountain copper mine. On the cliff overlooking the valley, the smelter's one brick smokestack pointed obscenely at heaven. I dragged my bags to the edge of the street. Carlo, my lover of 10 years, whom I seemed to have just left, would be sending a trunk from Tucson when he got around to it. I didn't own very much I cared about. I felt emptied out and singing with echoes, unrecognizable to myself. That particular feeling like your own house on the day you move out. I missed Hallie. Carlo, too, for the lost possibilities. At the point I left, he and I were still sleeping together, but that was all, just sleeping, with our backs touching. Sometimes Hallie would cough in the next room and I'd wake up to find my arm over his shoulder, my fingers touching his chest. But that's only because it takes your sleeping self years to catch up to where you really are. Pay attention to your dreams. When you go on a trip, in your dreams, you will still be home. Then after you've come home, you'll dream of where you were. It's a kind of jet lag of the consciousness. Carlo loved Hallie. When he and I moved back to Tucson, the three of us contrived a little household in a bad neighborhood with jade plants on our front steps that kept getting stolen till Hallie thought to bolt down the pots. We played house to beat the band. Hallie and I made prickly pear jelly, boiled and strained and poured blood red into clean glass jars. We'd harvested the fruits from the physical therapy garden of the hospital where Carlo worked. A nun saw us out there with our grocery sack while she was walking an old man around the little racetrack, and Hallie and I just waved. We said we were living off the land. Our home fell apart when she left. She was our center of gravity, the only one of us who saw life as a controllable project. Carlo was an orphan like me. We forgot about the jade plants. They went crisp as potato chips out on the porch, and Carlo withered as if he needed water also. Every man I'd ever loved had loved Hallie best and settled for me. It didn't bother me as much as you might think. I could understand it. I loved her too. And now his life with the Nolene women had run its course. He could go where he pleased. Carlo was a rolling stone, an emergency room doctor, which gave him a kind of freedom almost unknown to the profession. You can always find work if you're willing to take up with the human body as soon as possible after one of life's traumas has left off with it. Carlo and I met in medical school, and in our years together, he and I probably had more addresses than the Grace Arizona phone book. Along the way, I'd landed a few presentable jobs, but in between I tended to drift, like a well-meaning visitor to this planet awaiting instructions. My career track had run straight down into the weedy lots on the rough side of town. It's the truth. For the last 6 months in Tucson, I'd worked night shift at a 7-Eleven, selling beer and Alka-Seltzer to people who would have been better off home in bed. There wasn't a whole lot farther I could go. Now I was here. A high school friend, Emelina Domingos, had offered to meet my bus, but I'd told her, no, don't bother. I'll make my own way. The plan was for me to live in the Domingos guest house, not with my father. My relationship with Doc Homer had always improved with distance, which is to say that mail was okay and short, badly connected phone calls were best. I thought I should still keep some miles between us, even though he was ill and conceivably dying. It was going to be touchy. He would be an unwilling candidate for rescue, and I was disaster in that department myself. But he had only 2 living relatives, and the other one was behind the wheel of a Toyota pickup headed for Nicaragua. I stood my suitcases side by side and sat on them for a minute to get my bearings. I think I was hoping Emelina might still show up. There was no evidence of human life, or life that was ongoing in any obvious way. The one vehicle parked in front of the courthouse, a blue station wagon, had four flats and a bumper sticker stating, "One day at a time." I suspected it had been there in 1972, the year I finished high school, when I last climbed on a Greyhound and turned my back on Grace. There wasn't a soul on the street today, and I thought of those movies in which a town is wiped clean of its inhabitants for one reason or another. A nuclear holocaust, say, or a deadly mutant virus, leaving only a shell of consumer goods. The point, I think, is to make some statement about how we get carried away with all our trappings, but this wasn't the place to shoot a movie like that. Grace hadn't yet entered the era of parking meters, for example. There were iron rings mortared into the block wall of the courthouse where a person could tie a horse. I tried to imagine Doc Homer coming downtown on horseback, looking silly, his tall, stiff spine bouncing up and down against his will. I erased the fantasy from my mind, feeling guilty. It was too late to be taking imaginary revenge on my father. There wasn't much to Grace's commercial district. The window of the Hollywood dress shop leered from across the street, framing a ferocious display of polyester. The headless mannequins were dressed to the nines with silver vinyl loafers and red nail polish. If I moved a little, I could put my reflection there in the window with them, me in my Levi's and Billy Idol haircut. I was the one with a head. A friend of mine used to make bizarre collages like that, Nancy Reagan in mink among the slaves on an Egyptian mural, Malibu Barbie driving sled dogs in the Iditarod. She sold those things for good money. The Hollywood shop was flanked by Johnny's Breakfast, open all day, and the movie theater. Back behind these buildings ran the railroad tracks. On the other side of Johnny's were the State Line Bar and the Baptist Grocery. I tried to place myself inside these stores. I knew I'd been there. Directing Hallie through the grocery aisles on a Saturday, ticking off items from Doc Homer's list. Sitting in Johnny's afterward, hunched in a booth drinking forbidden Cokes, reverently eyeing the distant easy grace of the girls who had friends and mothers. But I couldn't see it. Those things didn't seem so much like actual memories as like things I might remember from a book I'd read more than once. I had lied on the bus. I'd told the woman sitting next to me that I was a Canadian tourist and had never been to Grace. Sometimes I used to do that, tell tales on buses and airplanes. It passes the time. And people love you for it. They'll believe anything if you throw in enough detail. Once I spent a transatlantic flight telling a somber, attentive man about a medical procedure I'd helped develop in Paris, in which human cadavers could be injected with hormones to preserve their organs for transplant. I would be accepting a prestigious medical prize, the name of which I devised on the spot. The man seemed so impressed. He looked like my father. I didn't do it anymore. I was more or less reformed. What I'd said that morning was the truest kind of lie, I guess, containing fear at its heart. I was a stranger to Grace. I'd stayed away 14 years, and in my gut, I believe I was hoping that had changed. I would step off the bus and land smack in the middle of a sense of belonging. Ticker tape, apologies, the luxury of forgiveness, home at last. Grace would turn out to be the yardstick I'd been using to measure all other places, like the mysterious worn-out photo that storybook orphans carry from place to place, never realizing till the end that it's really their home. None of this happened. Grace looked like a language I didn't speak. And Emelina wasn't coming. I hefted up my suitcases and started to walk. Oh, Lord, the terror of beginnings. I dreaded having to see all the people who were going to say, "How long are you home for, honey?" Possibly they would know I'd come for the school year. we would all carry on as if this were the issue, the job, not Doc Homer, who'd lately begun addressing his patients by the names of dead people. Since I really did need to come, I'd gotten myself hired to replace the high school biology teacher who'd recently married and defected without warning. I had practically no teaching qualifications, I should add, and things like that get around. It's tough to break yourself as news to a town that already knows you. Grace formed its opinions of Hallie and me before we had permanent teeth. People here would remember our unreasonable height in seventh grade and our unfortunate given names. Our father actually named my sister Halimeda, which means thinking of the sea, however reasonable a thing that might be to do in a desert. And my own name, Cosima, means something to the effect of order in the cosmos, which is truly droll, given my employment history. I must have sensed the lack of cosmic order in my future early on. Maneuvering for approval, I'd shortened it to Cody in third grade, when Buffalo Bill and the Pony Express held favor with my would-be crowd. Hallie was a more natural abbreviation. From the time she could walk, people never called her anything but that. Although Halimeda actually had some truth in it. She made you look for things beyond what you could see. I could imagine Doc Homer dreaming up these names, confident we'd both take noble courses. Suddenly, I felt dragged down by emotions as I walked along, as if I'd swum out into a calm sea and encountered a bad undertow. I carried my suitcases toward the edge of town. An old, densely planted pecan orchard stretched out from the edge of the courthouse square, and somewhere behind it lay Emelina's place. The reflected sky ran like a vein of silver in the irrigation ditch, but when I left the street and stepped under the canopy of trees, it was dark. If you've never walked through an old orchard, you have to imagine this. It presents you with an optical illusion. You move through what looks like a hodgepodge thicket of trees, but then at intervals you find yourself at the center of long, maddeningly straight rows of trees, standing like soldiers at attention. There's a graveyard in northern France where all the dead boys from D-Day are buried. The white crosses reach from one horizon to the other. I remember looking it over and thinking it was a forest of graves. But the rows were like this. Dizzying, diagonal, perfectly straight. So after all, it wasn't a forest, but an orchard of graves. Nothing to do with nature, unless you count human nature. A bird scream rang out from the leaves and echoed up my spine with a shiver that ended in my scalp. I believe it was the first sound I'd heard since the gear grinding of the bus. I stopped to listen. Quiet. Then another bird answered from behind me, close by. It sounded like the throaty, exotic laughter of a foreigner, like a jungle bird. The peacocks. These orchards were full of peacocks, living more or less wild and at the mercy of coyotes, but miraculously surviving in droves. There was a local legend, supposedly true, about how they got here 100 years ago. The 9 blue-eyed Gracela sisters came over from Spain to marry 9 lucky miners in the gold camp, sight unseen. Back then, these hills were run through with gold veins and drew a crowd of men who had too much money and too little love. The sisters were just children and only agreed to come if they could bring their birds with them in the hold of the ship. Their legacy in Gracela Canyon was a population of blue-eyed, dark-haired descendants and 1,000 wild peacocks. Their father stayed behind and got rich by proxy, for he'd literally sold his girls for a gold mine. The branches were ringing with bird calls now, and I could hear kids laughing. A whole chorus of them screamed at once. Toward the far end of the orchard, I could make out children's silhouettes jumping and dancing under the trees. It was dark in there for midday, but I definitely saw kids, little girls in billowy dresses and boys in white shirts. I couldn't make out their game. The tallest boy had a stick, and they were chasing something and flailing at it. I walked down the row toward them, towing my bigger suitcase like an anchor. I was traveling light in theory, but I'd dragged with me into Grace a substantial reference library. It had taken me a lot of nervous weeks to narrow down what books to bring. At the very last minute, I'd thrown out Grey's Anatomy because Doc Homer would have it. I stepped over the irrigation trenches, mindful of my Italian leather uppers. I'm picky about shoes, and there was no replacing these now. I smiled, thinking of the awful silver loafers in the Hollywood shop. I envisioned my predecessor at the high school dressed like that, standing in front of a classroom of 15-year-olds, twisting her white chiffon scarf as she explained cell division. What would these kids make of me? My shoes were pointed, and my, as the magazines say, personal style, leaned toward apologetic punk. I'd never had a teacher who looked like me. Probably there was a reason. I stopped to massage my aching shoulder. There was something up there at the edge of the orchard, all right, a bunch of kids, and something in the trees over their heads. I thought about skirting around the little gang to avoid spoiling their fun, or maybe actually because I was afraid. I could see plainly then that it was a heavy-bodied peacock shuffling from side to side on a low branch. Apparently the creature was too dull-witted or terrorized to escape, or possibly already injured. The children pursued it ferociously, jumping up and pulling at its long tail feathers, ready to tear it to pieces. The boy with the stick hit hard against the belly and they all shrieked. He hit it again. I couldn't see the stick, but I heard the sickening whack when it made contact. I looked away. I'd arrived in Grace, arrived at that moment in my life, without knowing how to make the kind of choice that was called for here. I'm not the moral guardian in my family. Nobody, not my father, no one had jumped in to help when I was a child getting whacked by life, and on the meanest level of instinct, I felt I had no favors to return, especially to a bird. It was Hallie's end of my conscience that kept pinching me as I walked. I dropped my bags and walked a little faster, trying to think of some commanding thing to say. If they didn't stop soon, the thing would be maimed or dead. "Stop it!" I yelled. My heart was thumping. "You're killing that bird!" The boy froze like a rabbit in headlights. The other kids, down on their knees, stared too. I'd arrested them in the act of grabbing fistfuls of bright paper and candy that sparkled on the ground. The mute peacock swung over their heads on a wire. Its fractured body hung in clay shards the size of plates, held together by a crepe paper skin. When I was 10, I'd demolished a piñata exactly like this one, with blue paper wings and a long glossy tail of real feathers, at a birthday party. At some time or other, every child in Grace had done the same. After an impossible few seconds, they went back to scrambling for their prize. Two older girls helped the smallest kids scoop candy into piles in their laps. A cluster of boys elbowed and slapped each other behind the girls' backs. I felt disoriented and disgraced, a trespasser on family rights. I walked away from the little group of kids back toward the place in the center of the orchard where I must have left my suitcases. I wondered in what dim part of Grace I'd left my childhood. Homero. Chapter 3. The Flood. The leaves shine like knife blades in the beam of his flashlight. The rain has slowed, but the arroyo is still a fierce river of mud and uprooted trees that won't crest until dawn. He is wet and chilled to his spine. The girls are lost. The sound of the flood makes his blood cold. They wanted to gather prickly pear fruits for jelly. They knew a storm was coming, and they went anyway while he was in his workroom. He follows the narrow animal path between thickets of thorn scrub along the bank, shining his light along the edge of the rising water. Acacias lean into the river with their branches waving wildly in the current, like mothers reaching in for lost babies. The girls ignore his cautions, because they are willful children who believe nothing can harm them. Hallie is bad, but Cosima is worse, pretty and stubborn as a wild horse, but without an animal's instincts for self-preservation. And she's the older. She should have some sense. He forces his body through the bank of oleanders near the house and turns back toward the riverbed to search the arroyo to the south. He has no idea which way they would have gone. They roam this desert like pocket mice. And everything in a desert is poisonous or thorned. Good Lord, he has already lost a wife and did not think his heart would live beyond her. Wished it wouldn't. He slashes at the oleanders with the metal flashlight. He'd meant to cut these down when Cosima was born. One well-chewed leaf could bring on cardiac arrest in a child. He'd seen a case years ago, or was it later, after the girls left home? That blue girl. Doc Homer sits up in his bed and stares at the orange pill bottles on the windowsill. There is light at the window. It's a Sunday morning in August. It is only a month ago he lost that blue girl. His own daughters are grown and living somewhere else, looking after themselves. But his heart is still pumping hard. His circulatory system believes they are still lost. He turns his pillow and rests his head on it carefully because his brain gets jostled and things move around inside his head like olives in a jar of brine. Think about the flood. He is going south on the near side of the arroyo. He stops to look back upstream and his light finds them, by pure luck, on the opposite bank. Cosima's thin, waving arms shine like the crisscrossing blades of scissors. They are screaming, but he only sees their mouths stretched open like the mouths of fledgling birds. Absolute expectation. Papa will save us. The road is washed out, and he has to think how else he will get to them. He realizes, stunned, that they have been huddled there for half a day. The road has been washed out that long. How does he reach them? A boat? No, that wouldn't have been possible. He sits up again. He has no clear image of reaching them, no memory of their arms on his neck. He only hears them crying over the telephone. And then he understands painfully that he wasn't able to go to them. There is no memory because he wasn't there. He had to call Yuda Dell on the other side of the arroyo. Her husband was alive then and went down the bank on his mule to find them in a washed-open coyote burrow with seven pups the girls wanted to save. "There were seven," she'd wailed over the telephone. "I could carry four, but Hallie could only get one in each hand, and we didn't want to leave the other one. He would have gotten drowned." Cosima is sobbing because in the end, after crouching for half a day in the small shelter of that gravel bank, waiting for the mother coyote to come back and save her children, they had to leave them. He hears Hallie shrieking in the background. They're both crying as if they are drowning themselves. Drowning pups. When he gets them home, they sit hugging each other on the davenport, wrapped in the black and red crocheted afghan. They won't stop shaking. They want to know if the baby coyotes died. If animals go to heaven. He has no answers. "We tried to put him in the paper bag we used for the prickle pears, but it fell all apart." The tears stream out until the afghan is wet and he thinks there will be no more fluid in them to run the blood cells through their veins. He makes them drink orange juice. God, why does a mortal man have children? It is senseless to love anything this much. Cosima. Chapter 4. Killing Chickens. Emelina's was a pleasant ramshackle place with animals, an old plum orchard, and five boys. When I walked up the drive with my suitcases, they were preparing to kill roosters. Emelina's eyes and mouth drew wide, and she looked briefly like a surprised fish. "Cody, this is Sunday. I thought you said tomorrow." "No, it was today. I'm here," I said apologetically. I was glad I hadn't waited any longer at the courthouse.
Shoo, you look like a $50 bill. Where'd you get that haircut, Paris, France?
She gave me a hug and waved her hand at the driveway.
I'm sorry about this mess. We've just got the water boiled for the birds. Shoot!
I'd just witnessed what I'd thought was going to be the slaughter of a peacock, so I laughed. But this time, it was real murder and mayhem. The drive was lined with pails, paper bags, and a tragically stained wooden block that had been used before. Emelina's twins, who were about 10, each held a fat white rooster by the feet. A younger brother was riding a tricycle precariously over the rocky ground. I put down my suitcases.
Curdie and Glenn, look at you, I said. And Mason, you guys are getting too big. Aunt Cody, look, if you hold them upside down, they go to sleep, Glenn said.
Curdie said, no, they get hypnotized.
Well, either way, it's a handy trick, I said. You don't want them to see what's coming. Emelina looked dismayed.
Cody, we don't have to do this now. What a god-awful thing to do in front of company.
I'm not company. You're all set up, so do it. You can't go out of your way for me if I'm going to live here. She rolled her eyes.
Go on back to the granny house, then. John Tucker was supposed to sweep it out this morning before he went to his baseball practice, but I'll fall over dead if he did it right now, instead of feeding the baby. I'll bet you $15 he's laying in the house watching the MTV.
John Tucker was Emelina's oldest, but I couldn't picture him old enough to feed the baby. I hadn't yet seen the baby, since he'd only arrived 6 months ago. But over the years, Emelina and I had kept up. I'd taped her kids' school pictures to the woodwork of Carlo's and my many ill-furnished apartments. Sometimes repairmen would ask if they were my boys. I went around to the side yard and pushed open a wire gate that wouldn't have kept out a determined hen. The guest house in the back faced the big ranch house across a huge brick courtyard that was wild and overrun with flowering vines. Every inch of space was taken up with fruit trees, painted flower pots, and lawn chairs that looked like they'd been there since the last war. I could hear chickens clucking softly somewhere out of sight, and at the back of the courtyard, a goat stretched its neck to get at a fig tree. The guest house had a pink door flanked by pots of geraniums whose crimson flowers stood out against the white walls like wine stains blooming on a tablecloth. Inside, the little house was whitewashed and immaculate. There were two brick-floored rooms, a living room and a bedroom. The light pouring in the windows was stirred up by the motion of fig branches outside. The bed had a carved headboard painted with red enamel, and a soft-looking woven spread. It was a fairy tale bed. I wished I could fall down and sleep 100 years in this little house with pale crisscrossing shadows on the walls. I heard the goat moving around outside, munching loudly and bumping against the wall. I opened cupboards. Everything was spotless. The east window in the living room looked straight out onto the granite wall of the canyon a few yards away, a startling lack of view. Emelina's place was the last and highest on her street, backed up against the canyon. The floorboards on her front porch were on a level with her neighbor's roofs. I took my time exploring. I savored the first minutes in a new home. Carla would always go straight to unpacking boxes, looking for the sheets and coffee pot and swearing that we were going to get better organized, while I stepped stealthily over the bare floors, peeking around corners and into alluring doors, which generally turned out to be the broom closet. But there was that thrilling sense that, like a new lover, the place held attributes I had yet to discover. My favorite book as a child was The Secret Garden. It's embarrassing to think I'd merrily relocated again and again, accompanying Carlo to the ends of the earth because of the lure of a possible garret or secret closet. But it might be true. I tried out the two very old chairs in the living room. They had rose slip covers and were comfortable. In a corner near the window was a beehive fireplace, and next to it, a clay vase of peacock feathers. Every home in Grace had one of those. It was a local feature. You could pick up half a dozen peacock feathers on any given day in the orchards as you went about your business. When the vase was full, you took them to one of the old women who made real feather piñatas, and then you started your collection over. The practice had not been allowed in our house because Doc Homer said the feathers were crawling with bird mites. He dreaded to think what those old women's houses were harboring in the way of microorganisms. It became Hallie's and my joke. Whenever he unreasonably forbade us to do something, we'd look at each other and mouth the words, bird mites. The bathroom and kitchen must have been added on about mid-century. The refrigerator looked prehistoric, but worked. It contained a loaf of fresh bread in a paper bag, some tomatoes and figs, a block of goat cheese, and a six-pack of Miller Lite, and Melina's estimation of the bare essentials. I popped open a beer and went back around the house in time to witness the demise of the second rooster. "Is it okay that there's a goat loose in the courtyard?" I asked Emelina. "Shit, I'm going to tan John Tucker's hide. John Tucker," she yelled, "get your damn goat out of the garden, please, or we'll have him for dinner." There was a noise from inside, and the back door slammed. "You don't really want to watch this, Cody," she said, "but I guess you see a lot worse in your line of work." I sat on the porch rail. I was no longer in the doctoring line of work. It's true I'd been educated to within an inch of my life, and had done well in medical school. My mistake was assuming medicine was a science like any other. "If it's carburetors, you know, you can fix cars," I reasoned. "If it's arteries and tendons, you fix people." For reasons that were unclear to me, I'd learned the science but couldn't work the miracle. I'd had a crisis while trying to deliver a baby. My problem turned out to be irreversible. And Melina knew all this. I was here, after all, with no more mission in life than I'd been born with years ago. The only real difference between then and now was wardrobe. "Tell me if I can help," I said. She ignored me. "Okay, watch your hands, Curdy. Keep them way back." Emelina was small, but didn't give that impression. Her jeans had little cowboy stitched on the label and undoubtedly belonged to one of her sons. Emelina and I graduated from high school the same year, 1972. Under my picture in the yearbook, it said, "We'll go far," and under Emelina's, it said, "Lucky in love." You could accept this as either prophecy or a bad joke. I'd gone halfway around the world and now lived 3/4 of a mile from the high school. Emelina had married Juan Teobaldo Domingos the same June we graduated. Now JT worked for the railroad and, as I understood it, was out of town most of the time. She said it didn't bother her. Maybe that's as lucky as love gets. Curdy laid his hypnotized rooster on the block and held its feet, keeping the rest of his body as far away as possible. It never regained consciousness. Emelina swung the axe over her shoulder and brought it down on the mark. The pink, muscular neck slipped out of the collar of feathers as if the two parts had been separately made. The boys hooted and chased after the body as it thrashed across the dirt, but I was fascinated by the head. The mouth opened and closed, silently, because the vocal cords were in the part that had been disconnected. "That's the way, Curdy," Emelina directed. "Don't get blood on your brother. Dip him all the way in. Now pluck him quick or he'll go stiff on you. Start with the wings. See how Glenn's doing?" She wiped perspiration out of her eyes. I was amazed by the muscle definition in her upper arms and her easy command of the axe. Her hands stayed surprisingly clean through the whole operation. She reminded me of Hallie, the way she could do things. Though, of course, Hallie would never decapitate anything. "I can't believe you're watching this," she said, when both boys were settled down to plucking feathers. She went inside and came out with a beer. She sat down next to me on the wide wooden rail, knocking the heels of her sneakers against the crossbar like a child. I was very conscious of my height. Sometimes I had an acute feeling that small women were better put together somehow, more in control of their bodies.
"You used to have a hissy fit when we'd go over to Abuelita's and she'd be killing chickens," Emelina said. "Remember? Even when we were big, 12 or 13.
"No, that was Hallie. She's the one that had such a soft heart. We've always been real different that way. She'd cry if she stepped on a bug." I drained my beer.
"She's still like that, except now she cries about bag ladies, I swear. She gives them quarters and then she wishes she'd given them a dollar."
I stared out at the treetops and the leaf-green gables of the roof on a house below us. The shingles were an odd, elaborate shape like the spade in a deck of cards. I wondered in what decade they'd stopped making shingles like that and how this neighbor might repair the roof after a bad storm.
"You really do look great," Emelina said. "That's a terrific haircut. I mean it. You'll stand out in the crowd here till you get your first cut down at Beth's butcher shop."
I ran my fingers over my weedy scalp, feeling despair. I'd spent my whole childhood as an outsider to Grace. I was willing to march downtown and submit myself to butchery this minute if that would admit me to the club. I'd led such an adventurous life, geographically speaking, that people mistook me for an adventurer. They had no idea. I'd sell my soul and all my traveling shoes to belong someplace.
"I always forget you have so much auburn. Doc Homer had the same coloring, didn't he? Sort of reddish before he went gray?"
She fingered her own shoulder-length hair.
"Speaking of him..."
"Speaking of him," I said. "Have you talked to him?" She looked apprehensive. Emelina was my informant. When he started getting lost on his way home from the drugstore, she was the one person in Grace who thought to call me rather than just draw him a map. "I'll go up and see him tomorrow," I said.
"And where's Hallie gone? You told me, but I forgot."
"Nicaragua," I said, "to save the crops. Cross between Johnny Appleseed and a freedom fighter." Emelina laughed, and I felt disloyal. I hadn't meant to sound glib. It was just hard to put Hallie into the context of regular life.
"I guess it's really dangerous," I said, "but she's excited about it. She'll be happy."
I was sure of this. Hallie didn't have my problem. She belonged wherever she was. Emelina nodded. She watched the boys, who sat cross-legged on the driveway, transfixed by the importance of their task. They were dappled with blood and looked like they'd been through a strange war themselves, a children's war. A scarlet bougainvillea covered the front porch. In fact, it was so overgrown that the wood of the vine seemed to be supporting the structure over our heads. The breeze coming up the valley felt like a warm liquid against my arms and face. I held the sweaty beer can against my temple and watched the bougainvillea arms swaying around us like seaweed under the ocean.
"No," Emelina said after a while. "I'm sure it was you that had a fit over the chickens. You'd start and then Hallie would do it too. She always followed whatever you did."
"No, Hallie, we're chalk and cheese.
Somebody ought to do a study on us if they want to know how kids in the same family can turn out totally different. She was born with her own mind."
"Maybe she was, but she copied you like a picture," Emelina said.
"She used to get so pissed off at me because I wouldn't go along with your boycott of Abuelita's chicken and rice."
I didn't remember organizing boycotts.
"Well," I said, "you're the witness here. Blood all over the driveway, and I didn't faint."
"People change," she said. "Not everything stays with you all your life." I sat watching my suitcases for a good 15 minutes, as if they might become inspired to unpack themselves. And then I went into the bedroom and lay down for just a minute, letting my shoes drop one at a time onto the brick floor. I tried to think how far Hallie might have gotten by now. Guatemala. Maybe farther. It was frightening to speculate on specifics. I'd been rationing my thoughts about her, but now I was exhausted and my mind ran its own course. I thought of Hallie at border crossings. Men in uniforms decorated with the macho jewelry of ammunition. No, not that far. I pulled her back to Tucson, where I'd seen her last, and she was still safe. She had come by the 7-Eleven, all packed up, at the end of my graveyard shift. She knocked her knuckles on the plate glass to get my attention. I locked the cash drawer and took off. Sparrows were ruffling themselves in the sheets of fresh rain on the asphalt. As I walked her across the parking lot to her truck, I could see just how we'd look to somebody, hanging on to each other by the elbows, like two swimmers in trouble, both of us equally likely to drown. Or maybe only one of us was holding on for dear life. It was hard to believe I'd once been the one to strike out bravely for college, leaving Hallie crying in front of the Baptist grocery. Now it seemed like I was the baby of the family, the one with no firm plans, who's allowed to fiddle around forever, keeping everyone young. Hallie was headed for a war zone. She walked straight through the puddles, dragging me along, and I had to stretch out my legs and drench my shoes to keep up with her. When Hallie was intensely excited, she had a wild animal look to her that could stop people in their tracks. A vibration came from her skin, like a bell that has just been struck. Her hair was long and reckless, curling wildly in the humidity. Every part of my sister could stir rebellion. I was thinking that if anything happened to her, I wouldn't survive. I couldn't see that there would be any method or any point. As long as I held Hallie's arm, she would still be here. She wouldn't be climbing into the truck, turning the key, driving south through Arizona and Mexico and the perilous places farther on. Wouldn't be stopped at a roadblock by men who might blandly shoot her in the head for being 29 years old and alone and female, wearing blue jeans, carrying antihistamine pills in her glove compartment. It seemed like a chain of events I could hold back, there in the parking lot, with the bones of her elbow securely gripped in my hand. Her little beat-up pickup looked impossibly loaded, like the tiny burros you see in postcards carrying elephant-sized burdens without complaint. I wasn't worried about the truck. I asked where she'd put her antihistamines. We knew of a photographer who'd been shot, ostensibly for running drugs, because he had a baby food jar of aspirin and vitamin tablets in his camera bag. Hallie said her pills were no place easy to find. I put my head on her shoulder. What if our houseplants die? They won't, she said. Hallie knew I wanted easy answers. I lifted my head again and she stared at me thoughtfully. The sky had cleared. The early morning light behind her head was orange, making her hair glow, and she looked like an angel. She never had any idea how she looked to other people. She thought she was plain. If the flea beetles start getting at the ones on the porch, she said slowly, dust them with sea light. Hallie worked for the Extension Service and answered the garden hotline 626-BUGS. For a period of years ending on that day, garden pests were her life. I hugged her with all the strength in my arms. Hallie, I said, could you please just change your mind now and not go? You really love me, so you want me to stay here and keep the suburbs safe for geraniums. I know how I ought to feel, I said. I just don't. Her breath expanded her chest against my arms, and I thought of the way a tree will keep on growing after a fence is wired around its trunk. The unbelievable force of that expansion. And I let her go. She started up her truck and waved from the corner, not a mournful gone-forever wave, but a chin-up wave like you see in the World War II movies, where everybody is brave because they all believe in the same thing. I told myself, because I had no other choice, that Hallie would do all right.
that we were both going to live. I walked the 6 blocks home under dripping trees and a sun that was already too hot. Across the street, I heard a woman say to her companion in an odd accent, "It's the desert museum." I had understood him to say the dessert museum, and obviously I was expecting something quite different. I thought, this is how life is, ridiculous beyond comprehension. What I felt wasn't pain, but a hollowness, like a drum with the skin stretched tight. It took me 5 minutes to get our front door open because everything in Tucson with moving parts gets cantankerous in the rainy season. Hallie had meant to put graphite in the lock before she left. A white balloon left over from her going away party followed me from the living room into the kitchen. It was the size of a head and had lost some helium, so it hung at eye level, trailing its string along the floor like a tired old ghost. Static electricity drew it along behind me. I swatted it away from my head while I plundered the refrigerator. I found some red bell peppers that had been absurdly expensive at the health food market, and washed one and ate it standing up in the kitchen. After that, I found a paring knife and went to work on a cucumber. I didn't feel like cooking breakfast just for myself. Carlo was at the hospital, and I had no idea when he was due back. The phone rang and I jumped, I suppose because I felt guilty for standing in the kitchen eating costly vegetables. I was afraid it was going to be somebody with garden pests, but they'd already turned off the garden hotline. It was Hallie, calling from a payphone this side of the border to tell me she'd forgotten to graphite the lock. "I knew you'd call about that," I said. I was filled with strange joy because she felt the same way I did, that we couldn't survive apart. I just stood still for a minute, giving Hallie's and my thoughts their last chance to run quietly over the wires, touching each other in secret signal as they passed, like a column of ants. You couldn't do that kind of thing at international rates. "There's a library book, too," she said. "Those Baron Munchausen stories. I found it in with my books when I was cleaning out my room." "I know. I saw it. I'll take it back today." "That book's got to be overdue, Cody. You were reading it in the car a month ago when we drove to Bisbee." I took a bite out of the cucumber and chewed before answering. I wanted this phone call to last forever. I wanted to recall every book we'd ever read aloud together while driving. "You're right," I said. "It's overdue." "Take it back and pay the fine, okay? Libraries are the one American institution you shouldn't rip off." "Yes, ma'am," I said. "Miss Pattyhurst the second." I heard her trying not to laugh. Hallie was intellectually subversive and actually owned a copy of Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book, but by nature she was perversely honest. I'd seen her tape dimes to a broken parking meter. "Apart from moral reasons, they'll cancel your card." "I don't know why you think I'm such a library outlaw. I'm all paid up over there." I munched on the cucumber. It wasn't that different from eating an outsized apple, say, or a peeled peach, and yet anyone looking in the window would judge me insane. "Don't worry about me, Hallie," I said finally. "Just worry about yourself." "I'm not worried about myself. I'm the luckiest person alive." It was an old joke, or an old truth, grown out of all the close shaves she'd walked away from. Bike wrecks, car wrecks, that kind of thing. I'd always been more or less a tragedy magnet, but Hallie was the opposite. One time, she started out the door of the old science library at the university and then turned around and went back in because she'd left her sunglasses by the microfiche machine. And 2 seconds later, the marble facade fell off the front of the building. Just slid straight down and smashed. It looked like Beirut. Hallie didn't believe she was invulnerable. She was never one of those daredevil types. She knew she could get hurt. What I think she meant was that she was lucky to be on her way to Nicaragua. It was the slowest thing to sink into my head how happy she was. Happy to be leaving.
We'd had one time of perfect togetherness in our adult lives, the year when we were both in college in Tucson, her first year, my last, and living together for the first time away from Doc Homer. That winter, I'd wanted to fail a subject just so I could hang back, stay there with her, the two of us walking around the drafty house.